Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Disfrute del espectáculo! Hey everybody, welcome to AnimeCast. Before we get started this week, I just wanted to explain the timing here and exactly why you're hearing about Evangelion for two shows in a row. Last week I announced I wanted to do an Evangelion panel because I noticed the fandom had become sort of fractured and there were multiple sides and people kind of fighting with each other. And I wanted to get a bunch of those guys in the same show to get the debate, have a debate. I thought that would be interesting. Now, what I didn't expect was that there was a bunch of drama and most, you know, they wouldn't appear with each other. I couldn't get the V for Vendetta guy and, you know, Aaron Clark to appear on the same show. And these were the two sort of primary players in this online drama that I was seeing unfold. They wouldn't appear. So last week, it was getting a little late, so I decided to do a call-out show, and the V for Vendetta guy asked me to be on. And so I had him on, and it turned into what you heard last week, which was a short segment in the call-out show and then a two-hour argument. So then this week, I still wanted to do the Evangelion panel because I had the opportunity to have Carl Horn on. So this week we're going to have this panel discussion. Hopefully you'll enjoy it, and hopefully you're not too sick and tired of hearing about Evangelion at this point. I promise from this point forward, we will have a ban on talking about Evangelion for the foreseeable future on this program. So hopefully you enjoyed this week, and have a great holiday weekend. Now let's go ahead and get to that panel. Okay, joining me now for our discussion of Evangelion is sort of elder statesman of anime and manga fandom in the U.S. for sure, manga editor at Dark Horse and you know, well-known personality Carl Horn is with us, and the co-founder of AvaGeeks.org and from AvaMonkey.com is Aaron Clark is with me as well. Hi guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us on.
No problem. So before anything else, what I really wanted to start out with here, in a broad sense, this is one of the few shows that is still popular 15 years after the fact. It is still huge. It is still a giant moneymaker in Japan. They're still releasing stuff for it. It never really went away, if you think about it. They've been sort of trickling stuff out over the years. Starting with Carl, what do you think is the secret here? What is keeping this franchise alive for more than a decade now?
Well, I think if there's, you know, as you know, Evangelion started off as a television series, and then it was two movies, and it's had all kinds of incarnations and games and manga and the new movie series. But if you look at what they all have in common, it's fairly straightforward. They have a set of characters. They all have the same characters in common. And the reason I think it survived so long is because the show happened to give us a bunch of characters that have become iconic. And people now think of the Shinji-type character, or the Asuka-type character, or the Misato-type character, you know. And you even see these in other anime as well. So even people who don't know anything about the series necessarily, and aren't really into, you know, the quote-unquote secrets of Evangelion, kind of like these personalities and these types. I was in Mandarake not too long ago, which is, some people may know, is the great store for used manga and fan stuff in Japan. And I saw this Yankee girl who didn't look at all very otaku, you know, enthusiastically buying the latest Asuka figurine. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, these characters just sort of, you know, kind of passed into iconography. So people just know them, and they don't necessarily have to get into the depths of the story or the, again, the mysteries of the show. They just kind of like the characters, and they can enjoy them that way. So I would say that that's the common thread that goes the last 15 years, and that's what people are coming back to see.
So that's a good point. The fact that they've kept the Rei and Asuka figure business has never slowed down, even really for a moment. So you could conceivably have fans that just collect those figures and really aren't into the show at all. They just like the fact that they can buy this redhead girl in any variety of wacky costumes. That's interesting.
Yeah, it can't necessarily be the story or the mysteries that have kept it going for 15 years, because there have been different stories and different interpretations and different endings. So those things can't be the common factor. So when I look at it, I sort of, if you have to answer that question simply, yeah, it is the characters. They've kind of become icons, maybe shorthand icons, you know, maybe they're simple images, you know, Rey's the quiet one and Asuka's the bitchy one. But nevertheless, people respond to them and they have this sort of glamour and they become these archetypes. So that's how I'd answer the question.
Interesting. Aaron, what's your take?
I'd reiterate a lot of similar things, that the characters are at this point very iconic. They're relatable and likable, but also in that kind of love to hate kind of dynamic. And those characters are still likable after 15 years, which says a lot. I think it's also that the story, the mysteries, the plot, the themes are, you know, so open-ended that they can be endlessly debated and interpreted in different ways. And not just in terms of, like, you know, what does the plot mean, but also, like, what is the, you know, what does this mean to me, you know, personally? And that sort of personal resonance that, you know, lives with you after, you know, 10 years. Like, you know, I watched this show when I was 16 and a totally different person, but, you know, it had an enormous impact on me and who I was at the time. And even now as an adult, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, because to me, ever since I first saw the show and now more so than ever, I've always felt in my personal interpretation of the show, it's primarily a show about depression. And it dealt with some really dark feelings, really dark emotions in a way that when I first saw it, I'd never seen a piece of animation do that before. And more so than, you know, arguing about the religious symbolism or anything like that, just those raw sort of negative human emotions on display in that show is a big part of what makes those characters so relatable. And so you can connect to them so easily. So I think that's a good connection there to make, is that they are sort of representative of these emotions, and that's why people connect to them so readily and so and for such a long period of time. Because I think up to that point, I can't think of anything else that was quite had penetrated popular culture quite that much that really dealt with that sort of thing in animation. I don't know if either of you would agree with that.
Well, I can't think of anything personally.
You still hear some of the same criticisms being made of Evangelion that were made back when it came out.
Yeah.
That it wasn't well structured, it wasn't well thought out, you know, it was low budget, that Anno didn't really know what he was doing. And those criticisms are probably kind of missing the point, and since the show is still around after 15 years, you know, we can see that they were kind of, they didn't seem to stop people. It goes back to what you said. The show was unusually emotionally direct. The phrase I used is that most anime are masks, but Evangelion was actually a face, by which I meant you could actually sense there was an actual person behind this, that this actually meant something to that person. I was reading an interview with one of the guys who's the writer of, you know, The Wire, that show on HBO, and he was talking about when they sit down to do a series of like 13 episodes, they're very conscious of the fact that they've been given this green light, and it's kind of a gift. They've got 13 episodes. Now, what are they going to do with them? What are they going to say with them? And he was saying, I don't know if this is a question that goes on when people write a lot of shows. It's more like, okay, what are we going to fill up the time with? And I think in this case, you know, not every anime series can be like this. Anno and Gainax really wanted to say something personal and real. Now, it should be remembered that the show is very good value for entertainment. It's not like it's a bunch of talking heads and just people sitting around, you know, philosophizing. There's a lot of great action in it, a lot of great design, a lot of great fan service and characters. So there's a lot to look at. There's a lot to enjoy. But nevertheless, it was kind of a very direct and honest emotional expression, which we're probably more used to seeing in music, but not necessarily in anime. You know, often you watch an anime, and it may be a very well-crafted work. It may tie up all its plot ends neatly, you know, but what was really the point of it? You know, it killed some time for you, but did it actually, you know, did it actually touch you personally? Did it make you think? You know, did you sense there was a sense of sincerity behind it? So I was, yeah, very much attracted to that sense of kind of authenticity and sincerity, which you don't often get from an anime show.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the fact that most of that stuff, I mean, in my opinion, now you guys might disagree, the real good stuff in Evangelion doesn't kick in until after about the 9th or 10th episode, which is usually when I decide to rewatch the show, where I'll start, because I kind of want to get right to the good stuff. But when it starts getting real nasty emotionally, that's when I turn on. That's when I'm sitting up paying attention. And it took a while for the show in Japan, even when, as it was airing, it took a while for the show to build up steam and get to that point where it was saying something interesting about human emotions. It did have a face. So, I mean, I guess I would personally argue that the first third of the show, the mask is there and they slowly take it off, using your terms, Carl. I don't know if you guys would agree with that.
The moment I first saw the mask slip off, if we're going to use that term, is in episode 4, Hedgehog's Dilemma. There's a scene, Shinji has run away, and this scene, of course, is done again in the 1.0 movie. And at one point, he's hiding out in a movie theater. It's almost deserted, and there's a movie playing, but he's not really watching it. Instead, he's watching a guy and a girl make out. And the expression on Shinji's face, that was kind of the moment when I first thought, I've never seen anyone make that expression before in an anime TV show. You know, you were sort of, his sense of kind of isolation, loneliness, disgust, you know, disgust at himself maybe, disgust at them. It was, again, this kind of bit of emotional nakedness, you know, not just a smiley face that you don't usually see. It wasn't part of the standard range of anime expressions. And while I think you're right, the show definitely did evolve and gradually changed its tones of the series, that was kind of my first indication that there was something different about the show.
Aaron,
it's
go ahead.
It's interesting that you'd mention that episode being kind of a distinct shift, is that that's the one episode in the entire series that Ono did not write or co-write. It was one of those episodes that was written by one of the other scriptwriters that was kind of, you know, like argued, like, we really need a little bit more time to develop this character out before we, you know, get to our next character, who is Rei. But I would say that, you know, starting in the second half, as opposed to like the, you know, the second third of the series, you know, after the after that clip episode, the kind of reviews over all the different angel attacks, you know, and we get into the monologue with Rei, you know, that's when it just takes like this distinct shift away from the action arc, which is, in my opinion, the kind of the lowest point in the series. It's so tonally different from everything else in the show.
Yeah, and that's a good thing just to briefly note that Gainax is a collective, and they're known for a more collective aspect to making a series than other anime studios. Ono famously said in an essay that appeared in the at the end of Volume 1 of the manga in Japan, several months before the series actually came out, that he did not know how the series was going to end, and he wouldn't know until he and the people working on it evolved their thoughts in the course of making it. So you bring up the fact that Hedgehog's Dilemma was not, you know, written or directed by Ono, and, you know, this may have been an indication of that type of, you know, collective writing, and, well, let's get a different perspective on the characters.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned, and that sort of crystallizes what I think is so different about that show tonally, the notion of self-disgust. These characters, pretty much every character in that show, has a moment where they reveal that they hate themselves, for better or worse, or they're disgusted with themselves or their actions. That's really rare. Really, really rare. I can't think of another show right off the top of my head that deals with that emotion quite as much as Evangelion does. And I think that's part of what makes it kind of special. I mean, American films, you know, especially, you know, sort of navel-gazing indie flicks, definitely wallow around in self-disgust a lot. But it isn't really I don't think it's a common theme in Japanese media or entertainment at all. I could be totally wrong about that. Carl, you probably know a lot more about that than I do.
Well, Aaron, what do you think?
The thing that I would rather focus on than the concept of disgust or self-disgust is that it seems like every character in the show is fundamentally flawed in very similar ways, but different enough so that there's always like there's a character that you can relate to or identify with, for better or for worse, you know, like the idea of stepping outside of your own body and looking at it externally and giving yourself perspective on who it is you are.
Yeah, not. I think disgust is a theme shared by many of the characters. I don't know if everyone
Absolutely.
Has it. For example, I don't know if Rei Ayanami has it. She had a very unusual upbringing and a very unusual sense of self, which part starts to be explained in that scene you mentioned, that once Evangelion starts losing its conventional narrative, you know, that monologue that Rei delivers about the halfway point of the series. This is a kind of a dated reference, but in a way Evangelion, of course, is a dated show. It came out 15 years ago. And Evangelion premiered in 1995. It was right after the whole Seattle music scene. It was the year after Kurt Cobain killed himself. And, you know, famous Nirvana quote, you know, "I hate myself and I want to die." And I was really into that music. I really liked it because, again, it felt very authentic and sincere. And so when Evangelion came out, I was kind of surprised, saying, wow, there's this anime that kind of has the same, you know, type of, you know, feelings, same type of honesty. So I was kind of coming off that vibe. It's just my generation as a, well, you might say a first-generation Evangelion fan. But I sort of connected with that, and then that sense of kind of trying to make some energy out of disgust, or maybe vice versa.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah. That's kind of what I was saying. I mean, when I said, like, you know, the characters all sort of at one point have a moment, I think even the Rei Ayanami character is a little self-aware about the fact that she doesn't value her own life seemingly at all. Period.
You're saying that you feel that her disgust comes in when she's ashamed of not valuing her life?
Yeah, sure. I would definitely make that argument. Now, I've not, you know, I've seen the show, I don't know, three times maybe all the way through, and, you know, maybe I focus a little bit too much on that. But I'm saying I found moments in each character where they were painfully self-aware. And I think that's just unique, for definitely very unique for an anime. You don't really see self-aware characters that often. Certainly not. Especially not nowadays.
Well, in the sense that the show can be seen as an exercise in psychotherapy and psychodrama,
mm-hmm.
then yes, I think it's very appropriate to note the moments of self-awareness in the characters.
Right. Right, for sure. But we should probably sort of get into the whole religion thing just to get past it. How important do you guys, starting with Aaron, how important do you really think all the religious symbols are? How important do you think those are to the show?
They're not the end-all, be-all. Mm-hmm. of the show, and they're not totally frivolous. There are a few quotations out there that discuss this, you know, from Gainax, you know, about how they chose it because it's an exotic religion in Japan. Principally is the statement that assistant director Kazuya Tsutamaki made at Otakon. I think it was on Akadot's website back in the day, in an article called "Amusing Himself to Death." He said something along the lines of, because I don't have it in front of me at the moment, that it didn't really mean anything, that it was kind of there to be cool, you know, because and if they had known that it was going to be popular in the West, they would have gone with something different. But if you look at sort of, if you research the different things in the show, different symbols, different themes, they are inconsistent in how they are used. For instance, in End of Evangelion, Unit 1 is crucified in space, and Shinji is kind of in the middle of all of it. And some people would say, oh, he's a Christ figure, and I would say, no, he's not, because, you know, Christ willingly sacrificed himself for the salvation of humanity, whereas Shinji is an unwilling participant, at least in the beginning of it all. So he's not making a sacrifice in this instance, even though he is, you know, more or less being crucified in space. In other instances, it kind of does make sense in a kind of a functional way. Misato's father leaves her his cross. When he sacrifices kind of himself to to put her in a pod so that she can survive. You know, some of these things kind of make functional sense, but other times, yeah, a cross-shaped explosion is just there to fill a visual aesthetic. But if anybody were to say, if I had two things to study, religion and sort of, I guess, either film theory or sort of the pop culture that influenced the show, I probably wouldn't say study religion, because it's not going to bring you to any great conclusions. And we as Westerners have enough sort of basic understanding of what this religion, you know, means. You know, we understand these symbols for what they are. You know, there's not really a great need to research them in depth, because, you know, there's not a whole lot more revelation to be had in terms of understanding the plot. But if you, you know, study things like the shows and literature that Anno and company incorporated into the show, then you kind of understand it creatively. And of course, some of the religious symbols, if you study those, you'll understand the show more creatively, but not in terms of plot. It's not going to arrive you at any great conclusions by studying Kabbalah, but, you know, it's also fun to do that. And, but, you know, it's not the end all be all of the show. It's just one component out of many.
Right.
Well, before I try to answer that question, first of all, I would agree with Aaron and sort of say in advance that there are lots of ways to appreciate Evangelion that have absolutely nothing to do with the religious question or issue. The reason I say that in advance is I've given the issue some thought. So when I explain it, it's going to sound maybe like this is the one single theory by which I personally look at Evangelion. It definitely is not. So just to get that, you know, disclaimer out there. As far as the issue of religious meaning in Evangelion, I think it might be a good idea to separate the question into three parts. The first part of the question is, and this is what a lot of people ask, was Gainax trying to express their own personal religious beliefs to the series? In other words, is Evangelion just VeggieTales with fan service? And I think the answer to that is no.
Yeah.
There was confusion about that point even in Japan, and I'll get back to that a little later. Because just like in America, Japanese religious groups have tried animation to get their messages out. If you've seen panels at U.S. conventions like Anime Hell or the Panel of Doom, they sometimes show clips of those, you know, real proselytizing anime. Now, the second part of the question is, in Evangelion itself, by which I mean within the fictional story, do religious ideas and concepts mean something in the plot and to certain of the characters? And there, I think the answer is yes. If you were to ask Gainax at a panel, were you trying to say in Evangelion that these Eva units, these giant armored, bioengineered alien hybrid clones, really exist? And they'd say, no, of course not. And then if you asked, well then, every time we watch the anime and see one of these Eva units in action, should we just ignore it being there and ignore whatever it does? You just said you don't believe they really exist. And I think at this point you can see the difference between the first part of the question and the second part. There are a lot of science fiction series that use strictly secular and scientific terminology and imagery. But in the world of Evangelion, there's a paramilitary and scientific organization called NERV that often uses religious terms and symbols. And sometimes we can see they're clearly more than symbols. Let me give you a real-world comparison. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the American military used to name some of their weapon systems after figures from Greek or Roman mythology. We had missiles named Atlas, Mercury, you know, Nike, and Zeus. If you live in the San Francisco area, you can still see the old Nike missile base in Marin Headlands. It's pretty cool. It's like something out of a Jerry Anderson show on the Otaku Tip. I got to note that he was also an influence on Evangelion. Anno's a big fan of him. But to get back to these missiles America used to have that were named after pagan gods, they were just names, and presumably they had no ceremonial aspects. I don't recall anyone ever reporting a manifestation of Zeus appearing in the sky during a test launch. By contrast, in the increasingly inaccurately named film, The End of Evangelion, a diagram of the Systema Sephiroticum, suddenly appears in midair between the Evas as the third impact begins, suggesting that a divine plan drawn up by a 17th century Jesuit based on the theory of medieval rabbis has some actual significance to the structure of reality as it exists in the fictional world of Evangelion. Now, as for requiring a coherent theory of what these religious symbols actually mean in the show before you can accept their valid to the plot, I would point out that in real-life religion, believers have been fighting over what their symbols mean for thousands of years, putting forward all kinds of rival theories, many of which contradict each other, and it hasn't slowed down the practice of religion one bit. And of course, a lot of people will look at any religious belief and say it doesn't add up. But that doesn't stop these beliefs from having a major influence on the what you might call the plot of the real world, why human beings do things and how they justify doing them. You don't have to accept religion, but religion by its very nature implies faith and speculation, not strict scientific testing. And speaking of science, do you also require a theory of how these Eva units, I mean, they're supposedly gigantic human beings, how do they manage to run and sprint and jump instead of collapsing under their own weight? How can the angels, who have powers not to mention appearances, completely unlike human beings, be said to be 99.89% genetically similar to humans? Or hey, how about that positron cannon? An antimatter beam weapon being used in the Earth's atmosphere. That doesn't sound too theoretically sound to me. And yet no one would deny the cannon is pretty important to the plot of Evangelion. So Evangelion is not exactly what you call a hard science fiction series. And yet there are some fans who are willing to accept its unexplained elements when they sound quote-unquote scientific, but reject its unexplained elements when they sound quote-unquote religious. But I would say both elements, regardless of whether they stand up to theory, seem to be working for the people inside the fictional story. I could also point out, and look, here I am pointing it out, this gets back to something that that Aaron said, these new movies, the new Evangelion movies, they're being made after people like co-director Kazuya Suramaki visited these U.S. fan conventions and assured us that Evangelion doesn't contain a religious message and that if they'd known it was going to be seen in the West, they wouldn't have done it. Yet, in the latest film, we see that Nerve has now started naming their bases after Bethany and Tabitha. These are towns where the New Testament said Christ performed miracles, and we're now told the nations of the world apparently abide by something called the Vatican Treaty that limits the use of their Eva units. These are new religious motifs. They weren't in the original 90s anime. In other words, if their encounter with Western fans made them think, hey, they totally misunderstood the first time, we've got to tone down this Christian stuff in future versions so they don't get the wrong idea, they kind of have a strange way of showing it. If anything, from an internal plot perspective, they kind of upped the ante. When you say Vatican Treaty, you're starting to get into, like, Helsing territory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to keep the religious element out of it, wouldn't it have been a lot simpler just to say it's a, I don't know, a United Nations treaty, since you already have the UN as an important player in the original series? Why have it be the Vatican specifically, which, you know, does represent the world's biggest Christian organization? And again, I don't think Gainax / Kara is trying to say this time out, we're all secretly Catholic, that's a message. But the way Evangelion is being rewritten in the new movies, it doesn't actually reduce the religious elements of the plot. So, the first part of the question was, is Evangelion some faith-based expression of what Gainax actually believes? And I think the answer is no. The second part of the question was, does it have meaning and function inside the fictional world of the story? And there I think the answer is yes. Now, the third part of the question, can Evangelion be seen? I say again, can it be seen, meaning you don't have to, but you can, as making observations about religious beliefs? And here I think the answer is again yes. And even though I just said the second part has gotten stronger in the new movies, the third part was arguably stronger in the original TV series and in the end of Evangelion. Because in the mortal words of the Colonel from Akira, memories are short. You have to remember what was actually going on in Japan in 1995. The first episode of Evangelion premiered in October of that year. 7 months before that, the Japanese religious cult Om Shinrikyo, which is already notorious in Japan for their apocalyptic preaching and their belief the world must be destroyed in order to cleanse it, they released nerve gas in the Tokyo subway, killing 12 people and wounding hundreds more. Om Shinrikyo, by the way, combined Hindu, Buddhist, and Christian concepts in their beliefs, and they were also known for attracting doctors and scientists to their ranks and pursuing high-tech and science fiction-inspired weaponry. When the police raided their headquarters, they found they'd been stockpiling chemical and biological warfare agents. A few days later, someone tried to assassinate the head of the Japanese National Police Agency. They shot him 4 times in front of his residence. 1 week after that, more gas bombs, this time full of cyanide, were discovered to have been planted throughout the Tokyo subway system. 2 weeks later, there was another assassination attempt, this life in the time the life of the governor of Tokyo. So basically, this is like something out of Akira or Pat Labor 2, but it was really happening in Tokyo. The actual events were wild enough, but as you might imagine, the media storm was even wilder. So this was the atmosphere in Japan as Evangelion began production. The trials of the cult members, which were highly publicized, began while Evangelion was on the air. And there was another media blitz around the first anniversary of the attack, March 20th, 1996. This was the air date of episode 25 of Evangelion, the beginning of the show's notorious two-part finale. Now, one more time, getting back to my disclaimer, there are lots of ways to look at Evangelion which have nothing to do with religion. But the idea that a show that involved Japanese people involved with high-tech secret organizations, prophecies, and violent apocalypse couldn't possibly be seen as some kind of comment on religious belief and what it can motivate people to do, well, to me, that would be like the wildest fan theory of them all. And that's basically my thought about the religion on Evangelion.
I mean, personally, just as a side note, you know, Evangelion is at its core an apocalypse story, and name me an apocalypse story that doesn't ever draw on any kind of arcane religious terminology or symbolism. They don't really exist. It's by its very nature, an apocalypse story generally includes that kind of thing. And I personally thought the religious stuff was sort of a fun flavor. It added an element of intriguing mystery to the show that I think is part of what has kept it so popular and so alive in the imaginations of fans, I think.
Yeah, and you remember how I started off by saying that I think the thing that has kept the series going for so long is the characters, and those cult attacks were 15 years ago, and I don't think they have much to do with what people are enjoying Evangelion for these days.
Sure.
But it is good to go back and look at what was actually happening back then and realize that, you know, there were real-life events going on outside in the streets of Tokyo, which certainly, you know, everyone was aware of.
Right, yeah, right, and seemed to have impacted the show itself. So speaking of the endings, I have to ask, which one do you prefer? And I guess I'll start with Aaron. Which ending do you like?
I guess the short answer is it depends. Mm-hmm. Now, as a disclaimer, in the fan community, there's like two contending ways of looking at the two endings. Like, there's the divergent view of them, that there are two totally separate endings, and then there's the convergent, where they are part of the same ending. I think that they're totally different endings, and I'm not going to argue one way or the other on them, but for the TV ending, it's the more personal one. It's the one about the self. It's, you know, it's like if you're having a bad day, or if you just, you know, you kind of want a more artful, psychological, thoughtful ending, that's the kind of one that I go for. But there are some times when I just kind of want the visceral, you know, plot, related, you know, ending. And I like both of them kind of equally, but for rather separate reasons, because they deal with similar things, but in very, very different ways. And they arrive at totally different conclusions, in my opinion. I've always looked at the TV series ending as Shinji remaining in instrumentality, choosing to remain in instrumentality, and choosing to allow himself to be connected to others, whereas in the movie he chooses to deny that, and basically the view of instrumentality is slightly different in that you don't really exist. So the question is, if you don't exist, if you don't exist, what's the point? And that's why he kind of chooses to return, you know, to his form and, you know, choose a life of, you know, occasional pain and misunderstanding, because that's the only real way that you can exist, because you can't just run away from your problems. So I like certain things about both endings, and it really just kind of depends on how I feel at the given time, whether I, you know, like one more than the other. But generally, they're kind of on evil level playing with me.
Carl?
Well, the question gets a little more complicated these days because there's going to be a third ending.
Right. Well, yes, we'll get to that, yeah.
You mean a fourth ending, right?
Who knows? And like
that manga will end eventually, won't it?
Yeah,
you've got the inside info.
Exactly. I mean, there will be a manga ending as well, but just going by the anime, there will be a third ending, and we don't know what it is. And so this changes the question because, as you phrased it, it's always been, do you prefer that version or that version? There are always two, and they sort of had a questionable relationship to each other. So I thought the movie was a very daring film. As you know, the Japan Academy Awards, they give out two Best Picture awards each year. One is our equivalent of Best Picture Oscar. The other is the most talked about picture, sort of a people's choice thing. And in 97, the Best Picture went to Princess Mononoke, but The End of Evangelion got the other award. And it was it's very unlike the Japanese Academy to give an award to a film like The End of Evangelion. You know,
right.
Ghibli kind of has things locked up still in many ways, you know, in terms of creative respectability, either a Ghibli film or a film that's trying to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, Patrick Macias, editor-in-chief of Otaku USA and amazing writer on, you know, the Japanese scene, he said that he thought End of Evangelion was a better film than Princess Mononoke. And I thought that was kind of blasphemous because, hey, it's Miyazaki, and I happen to think it's his best film. But he said, which movie's taking more chances? And I thought, well, if you start to look at it that way, and if you start to look at where is anime going as an art form and as a cinematic form, just like the television series took chances, you know, the movie took chances as well. I think it's very bold. One of the aspects of the television series ending I really like is its stage play-like dimension. As a matter of fact, as we can see, it literally is on a stage set. You know, we can see the markings where people are standing and the lighting and so forth. I've always been kind of surprised that no one's ever adapted it for stage, you know, kind of a fan production.
Hmm.
Seems to me you could do that, you know, in a fairly straightforward fashion. I don't think that either ending necessarily resolves to my satisfaction the psychological questions that are resolved by the series. I can't say that either ending actually gives me an answer I'm happy with, but that's not necessarily what I'm looking for out of the series. It's worth asking the question in the first place. It's worth admitting that there's a problem and, you know, making a show that's kind of honest and sincere than necessarily expecting, just as the plot isn't neatly wrapped up, I don't necessarily expect the psychological inquiry or the healing to be neatly wrapped up. So, you know, I'm not necessarily looking for either one to be the correct ending. I get a lot out of both of them.
Yeah, I mean, I like them both. I think they serve completely different purposes. That's my personal interpretation of it. I think I feel like the TV series ending is upbeat and the movie is not. And
I think it's possible to like a series and not agree with it, agree with everything it says, and not agree with all of its characters, even if you're supposed to agree with them.
Well, I've always argued that a lot of people, you know, throughout, you know, my many discussions of this show with friends over the years, I've had a lot of friends who say, I don't like that show. I don't like any of the characters. And I always felt like, but that's part of why I like the show, is because it kind of dares you to get involved in the lives of these people that are pretty hateable. Like, they're they're a little despicable. And that's part of the show's charm, I thought. You know, the ending is sort of the same way. I like the fact that it's sort of obtuse and doesn't really tell you everything, you know?
Well, take Shinji. I mean, the simple take on Shinji is that he's a whiner. That's how people sum him up. But, I mean, you be 14 years old and be thrown into life and death mechanized combat with no training whatsoever, you know, and see how many complaints you make. Never mind training. We're so used to the notion in anime of teens piloting stuff and piloting robots and going into combat. We forget in the real world that's called a war crime. They try your ass to the Hague for that stuff.
Right.
You know, and Evangelion, I thought, was actually treating it realistically, that it's a bad thing to ask kids to do this. It's really messed up, and it's likely to mess them up. I mean, Rei was sort of trained from, you know, birth, or whatever the appropriate term is in her case, for it. Asuka seems to be really gung-ho, but is you know, has problems of her own. Shinji, who's actually the best pilot, you know, is very upfront about his problems. And, you know, his dad doesn't help one bit. So I think you have to step back from these characters and say, hey, wait a minute, they're just teenagers. You know, did you have all your life problems worked out when you were that age? It's like, put down your pencils, time's up, here's your score. I was always interested in the characters. You have these tiers of ages. You have the children, but you also have people like Misato, Ritsuko, and Kaji, who are, you might say, old enough to know better and old enough to be responsible. And I think there's a tension between what they do and what the children are asked to do. There's a real moral dimension in there that you sort of have to question, you know, what's going on all the time. Can't take it for granted.
So, well, okay, but before we move on, I want to ask some questions about the manga here. Let me know if either of you guys have ever heard, I'm sure you maybe you've heard this story, but it's always stuck with me because I heard about the, I heard this story, I think right after I saw End of Evangelion for the first time in 97 or whenever the first fan sub tape got out there. Somebody told me that the final line in the film that Asuka says, she says, "I feel sick," sometimes translated as "you make me sick," which I think is different. somebody told me that Anno was dating the woman who was voicing Asuka at the time. And that wasn't supposed to be the final line of the film, but that's what she said in the recording booth because they were breaking up. Has anyone ever heard this story? And is there
Never.
Any truth to it?
I asked the co-producer of the film, Hiroyuki Yamaga, about it.
Yeah.
I was driving him to the airport at the time. This is right after he was leaving Fanime. And he was kind of leaning back in the chair. If you ever seen Jigen in the Castle Cagliostro, right before they get into the big car chase,
yeah.
it was just like that. I said this rumor about Anno and Yuko Miyamura going out, and it was kind of like, you know, oh, where'd you hear that? It was like, and he was sort of saying, no, that's not true at all. And he loves to gossip about Anno, so I'm sure if it were true, you know, he would have said so. No, it's my understanding that they simply had trouble. There's always been a lot of improvisation in Evangelion, and
really?
That, yeah. Well, I mean, in the making of the series, you know, we talked about how it wasn't all planned out from the beginning, and much of it was created as part of a, you know, organic process as they went into it. And apparently, my understanding is that, you know, Miyamura had trouble with what was originally going to be the final line, which I've heard was something like, "I'll never be killed by a guy like you." Is that what you heard, Aaron?
I've not heard much about that. I've heard about the direction that Anno gave her on how to deliver "I feel sick."
What I heard is that originally it was going to be a line like, I'll never let myself be killed like a guy like you," kind of sort of a, you know, oh, Baka Shinji sort of thing. But that it wasn't really working out, and that Anno eventually asked her to just sort of say, you know, what would you really say in a situation like this? You know, and you sort of have this, you know, kimochi warui, which can be translated a whole bunch of different ways, but I kind of like it because it's, you know, it's got a kind of existentialist tone to it. You know, sick of what? You know, what's the sickness here? Well, you know, just kind of the show kind of, you know, kind of slams to an end right there. It reminds me of the old joke, you know, not if you were the last guy on Earth. Right. Or here you have, you know,
yes.
The last you have the last guy and the last girl on Earth, and what does Shinji do? He tries to strangle her. So he'll be alone and presumably finally safe, so no one can ever hurt him again. One of the characters in Evangelion that I think you're supposed to like, and I don't like at all, is Shinji's mother, Yui Ikari. I kind of point out that Shinji actually gets worse throughout the entire series. He starts off as this kind of sullen, complaining kid. At least he's not, like, strangling girls. And he goes through this whole kind of rebirthing procedure, you know, cosmically, you know, uniting with his mother and all that. But it doesn't actually seem to help him one bit. You know, when he gets back, you know, to Earth, he doesn't really seem to be any better. If anything, he seems to be worse. I think the problem with Shinji's mother is that she doesn't really realize that he's not a baby anymore, and he needs to grow up. That's the, I think this is something that, say, Misato understood better. So I think there's a lot of bad parenting in Evangelion. It's not just Gendo. It's, you know, coming from his mother as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Shinji doesn't really have stable parental figures of any kind.
My favorite characters in the series are Misato and Kaji. And I kind of see them as, like I say, in scientific experiments, you always have the control. They're kind of the control, because mm-hmm. they're normal human beings. They're this kind of couple. They have a lot of problems. They have a lot of issues. But they're basically decent and loving people and try to do the right thing. So I like to think they're what Shinji and Asuka could grow up to be. In other words, if you don't obsess on the idea of trying to solve all your problems and to get rid of all of your hang-ups and to become a perfect person, you might find out there's a lot to be said just for being a human being, you know, just for sort of sticking it out and, you know, toughing it out and becoming a person that way. There's a kind of emotional hysteria in the series that people are so afraid of pain and loss that they want to annihilate their humanity and annihilate themselves. It's a, you know, disgust that becomes so powerful it becomes suicidal. And in Evangelion, people literally have the means to do that because of the technology at their control. You know, Gendo, you're supposed to feel sorry for, and he's supposed to be a tragic character because he lost his wife and he wants to reunite with her. Well, big deal. I mean, half the human race died in the second impact. I'm sure a lot of people lost their, you know, spouses. It doesn't give them the right to do this, you know, to the rest of the human race. Did we all take some kind of vote on the instrumentality? Did I miss something?
Wait a minute. I didn't know you were supposed to feel sorry for Gendo. I always thought he was a huge dick the whole time.
Maybe sorry is too strong a word, but it was, I think, supposed to give him the kind of tragic and humanizing dimension.
Right, okay.
Which, although I think in some ways he actually is more honest about himself than, again, that Yui is. There's that scene where they flash back to Shinji as a baby and Gendo and Yui standing underneath the tree in the bright sunshine. And Gendo's wondering if they've done the right thing bringing a child into this hellish world. And Yui talks about, well, he can make any place, you know, paradise, you know, or heaven if he wants to. But, you know, it's easy to say that when you have a cute little baby. It's maybe not so easy when he's 14 years old and he's being asked, you know, go through hell. So I think in a sense that, you know, maybe Gendo is being a bit more honest and realistic there.
Right. Okay. Before we get into the films, what I did want to talk about a little bit is the manga, which I am not woefully unfamiliar with and actually have tried to buy, but have had some difficulty finding some of the volumes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's a little tough to get.
Oh, yes.
So fill me in. What are the major differences? Because I've heard all kinds of hearsay and whatnot about how the story is very different, or it's told more straightforwardly, or it focuses more on the traditional anime style aspect, manga style aspects of the story. What are the chief differences? And I guess I don't know, somebody take this. Whoever wants to take it.
Well, there are four main Evangelion manga series. I guess you're talking about the original one?
I'm talking about the Sadamoto one, yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, Aaron, what's your take on that?
Carl, could you... the Petite Eva manga, could you count that as a standalone, syndicated manga, or is it just totally separate?
Well, they are starting to multiply now. I don't know if we're supposed to just count things that have multiple volumes or, you know, have been collected.
It's so hard to tell. Because technically, but there's either five or six. There's just so many of them. It's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not referring to like the Angelic Days or anything like that. I'm just referring to the
yeah,
one.
We're talking about the main one.
Yeah.
It's so weird because it's been going on for 15 years, and it's only 12 volumes now. You know, Sadamoto is just notoriously awful at producing the comic on a regular basis. And it's hard for a lot of people to kind of figure out, well, if he's not making the manga, like, what is he doing with his time? You know, he does illustrations. He does work on a variety of the Gainax stuff and also some work on other things like, you know, the new movie series, as well as, you know, doing stuff for, you know, in association with Ono's live action, you know, works. And, you know, he's done stuff for, like, you know, Dot Hack and whatnot. But still, it's so hard to reconcile how long it has been and how many months or how many stages he could have, you know, made manga for, you know, in that time, you know. Like, I feel awful. You know, like, I've been following the manga since, you know, like, I guess maybe 2002. I feel awful for anybody who's been following it since early 1995. You know, like, literally growing up, waiting for that ending, you know, that should have come, like, 10 years ago. But a lot of people like to rag on it. You know, they like to hate on it for being more or less fan fiction. But a lot of people don't really credit Sadamoto like they should, because it's, as Carl said earlier, Gainax is a kind of a creative collaborative. Ono really takes a lot of the credit for the success that is Evangelion. And that's kind of fair, because he is one of their, or was one of their, depending upon whether he is, you know, officially done with working for Gainax. Because I don't believe he's on their board anymore. But, you know, he was one of their principal creators back then. I mean, Evangelion is an encapsulation of his failure to create, you know, new and interesting IP for them for the period of several years following, you know, Nadia. And, you know, if Eva wasn't such a success, it would have just totally folded. But, you know, he made Evangelion his own in many ways, but Sadamoto deserves to be credited as a kind of a co-creator just as much, because in addition to kind of creating the characters and the look for the characters, you know, like Ono kind of said, you know, I'd like a character for this, I'd like a character for that. And there's some interesting interviews out there that kind of detail how Sadamoto had a pretty good hand in fashioning the characters, not just in their looks, but also in their personalities. So he's not just a visual designer on the show. And there's other things as well, like one of the most core concepts of this show is something that Sadamoto, you know, read about and said, oh, that's kind of interesting. Let's see if we can do something with that, which is the A10 neural connection. You know, the idea of the mother and the child and the Eva and the plug, respectively. You know, that was an element of the show that he, you know, really is responsible for. You know, and that's one of the most important things in the show. It's like, you know, that's one of the, you know, like, if you don't have that, like, half the show is just kind of gone. And you see that a little bit in the new movies. Like, I kind of look at it and I'm like, well, they haven't made it look like, you know, the souls of the mothers are, you know, in the Avas. Like, they totally bypass that completely, and it kind of feels a little bit shallow as a result. But, you know, I've always looked at Evangelion, or I guess in recent years I've looked at Evangelion as more a show by Ono with a separate but equal incarnation by Sadamoto, and more like a concept, you know, that was put together slightly haphazardly because of the urgency of creating an IP, because the studio is in such peril of just completely falling apart. And from that concept, you got two similar but very different interpretations of that original concept. And if you ever go back and look at that original concept, which was published in the New Type 100% collection and has been, you know, fan translated and circulated around a bit, you'll look at the last, like, I guess, third of the show, and kind of compare that to what actually happens in the television series. It's completely different. And, you know, I remember talking to Takeshi Honda back in 2004 at Katsucon. You know, he talked about how incredibly frustrating it was to work on the show when Ono would constantly be rewriting things kind of last minute as they were about to go into production on it. So he, I guess, you know, in the case of Honda, he'd kind of, you know, have these visual ideas of how the show is going to look, and then have that just kind of just taken and thrown away because, you know, Ono took what they were going to do and just totally changed it. And he comically said that he didn't talk to him for several years until they finished the end of Evangelion and he finally understood what Ono was trying to do. But, you know, between the end of the series and end of Evangelion, those two just didn't talk at all. But so, like, the manga is more like Sadamoto's interpretation of that original concept. And it kind of patterns itself off of the television show at times. And other times it kind of diverges and kind of follows more a little bit more along the lines of what the original concept has. For instance, Kaoru shows up earlier like he was supposed to in the original concept. There's fewer angels like in the original concept. I kind of like the way he kind of follows it a little bit more from Shinji's perspective. There's also elements from like Ava 2, the Mastema, I think it's called the Mastema, it's the double-bladed chainsaw, kind of makes a kind of random appearance. So he kind of pulls from kind of different places. I like it. I'd like it to finish at some point in the near future. That would be really nice. But I find it really amusing that Ono has managed to make or will have managed to make Evangelion two times over, whereas Sadamoto will still be chugging away at the manga, you know, one stage every 3 or 4 months.
Well, as for what Sadamoto does with his time when he's not drawing manga, since he's the guy who designed the characters that everyone's buying all these figurines of, I imagine he spends a lot of his time counting his royalty money. And this might be a good thing that I talked about how the thing that unites all the versions of Evangelion over the years is the characters. It may be that Sadamoto has had more to do with the people, the way the average person experiences Evangelion, than even Ono has. Because, you know, people think of Evangelion as a very dark and dramatic series, and in many ways it is. But those aspects of it are not expressed in the merchandise. I mean, you don't see any figurines of, like, the scene where, you know, Eva Unit 1 is fighting, you know, Bardiel, you know, with real blood-squirting action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't make, you know, these gory figurines. They're all with, like, you know, Asuka's crossing guard, you know, and things like that. You know, they're cheerful and happy, and they often tend to reflect the kind of, you know, paintings that Sadamoto does. It's no disrespect to Mr. Sadamoto to point out that though he is very talented as a manga artist, he's not really the type to do it on a regular professional basis. This goes back way before Evangelion. He made his professional debut in the 1980s, and he didn't even do enough chapters to do a single tankobon, and so that's one of his lost works. As you know, people don't often save their manga magazines in Japan. They throw them away. So it's very hard to track down this work of Sadamoto. He did another series for a new type back in the early 90s called Route 20, which also was, you know, not really completed. So it's not, you know, it's not something that he started with Evangelion. You know, you might say maybe he's in the same category as Shiro Masamune, you know, a person who is a very talented character designer and illustrator, and perhaps would rather do that with his time. So about the manga itself, he actually started drawing it about a year before the anime premiered. And this gets back, of course, to the fact that he was the character designer and co-creator of the series. So he had obviously early access to the scripts and where the series was going, at least in its original conception. So the early volumes of the manga hewed fairly close, you know, to the anime, starting to diverge more in volume 4. There are some things which I think that Sadamoto actually handles better from a dramatic standpoint than Ono did. For example, the scene where Tochi, who becomes an Eva pilot, and Shinji is sort of forced to fight him and, you know, practically beat him to death. As a matter of fact, in the manga, if I recall correctly, he does beat him to death. You know, he doesn't just get away with some limbs lost. But also, in the manga, Shinji knows from the beginning that Tochi is in there, and that makes it even more emotionally horrifying to him. It's, you know, not only is he having to commit this unintentional and vicarious act of violence, there's nothing he can do to stop, but he knows exactly who he's doing it to. The way Sadamoto handled Kaoru is one of the most controversial aspects of the manga in comparison to the anime. I pointed out that in the original anime, the original TV series, Kaworu actually shows up for only 13 minutes of total screen time, 1 minute of which is spent in complete silence, his last minute, you know, of existence. Yeah. One of Evangelion's famous 1 minute where nothing happens, you know, a great way to save on budget.
Yeah.
But the, you know, nevertheless, he made a tremendous impression. You might say he had this very brief, you know, kind of sort of questionable affair of the heart, you know, with Shinji. Whether anything physical happened, you know, is something that, you know, fans like to debate. But obviously Shinji had developed very sudden and strong feelings, you know, for this mysterious Kaworu guy. And as Aaron pointed out, Kaworu is introduced at an earlier stage, I believe in the end of Volume 7 in the manga. And he has quite a different personality. There's a notorious scene where Shinji first meets him in person, where they're out in the ruins of town, and the town's got plenty of ruins because, you know, the angels keep attacking. And they come across a stray kitten. And the kitten tries to follow Shinji, and Shinji tries to discourage it, you know, talking to the cat like it understands, saying that, you know, I can't take care of you and all that, and to sort of forget about it and walk on. Kaworu then picks up the cat and wrings its neck, kills it. And Shinji is horrified, but Kaworu says, aren't I really doing what you were doing? Said you were going to abandon it and it was going to starve to death. I'm just getting it over with. So as long as you're not going to take responsibility of that thing, isn't it better to just, you know, show mercy if you're not going to take care of that stray cat? And people today still blame Sadamoto for ruining the horrible Kaworu character. I mean, making him into this horrible guy. And I point out that in the original anime, Kaworu was, you know, just about to destroy the entire human race. You know, he only hesitated at the last moment. So it's amazing that you can have this sort of scene with a kitten and people get horrified, but billions of people can die, and that's just, you know, that's just background story.
I think that's just a general rule of entertainment. You can kill off half the world's population, hurt a dog, and the audience turns on you. So
exactly, and Sadamoto must have known that people were going to be mad at this. So I think he himself was taking some risks in taking this very, you know, beloved character, and of course a character which he had designed, and making him into something which was less spiritual, less ethereal. In the manga, Kaworu actually sticks around long enough to go on some fights against the other angels, which is ironic since he's an angel himself, and sort of develop the relationship more between Shinji and Kaworu. And the big difference is that whereas Shinji was in the anime immediately taken with Kaworu and felt he never met a person who understood him so well before, in the manga, right after that kitten thing, you know, Shinji hates Kaworu, can't, you know, stand him, and views him as this kind of arrogant creep. And yet, Sadamoto is still willing to develop the two of them, and also the issue of the, you know, possibly homoerotic, I say possibly, he's kind of, you know, plays around with that, attraction between them. At the end of every volume, Sadamoto also comments about the events of that story. And at the end of the volume where Kaworu dies in the manga, Sadamoto admits that he himself was starting to feel something for Kaworu as a character, and basically sort of speculates the idea that all his heroes growing up were men, and the idea that, you know, the idea that men can have love for other men, and that's just kind of a reality even if people don't look at it. So I kind of like the way that Sadamoto was being a bit more upfront and more direct. I think that his work is very far from fan fiction. First of all, of course, he's the co-creator of the series, so he's not exactly what you call a fan, that is to say, someone outside of Gainax. Even if his work has taken a long time to come out, I think he's always got something to say in the manga. And I'm looking forward to, you know, where it's going and what the conclusion is going to be. His tendency to have characters express things that maybe they didn't express in the original continues into Volume 12. There's a confrontation between Shinji and Gendo, which perhaps should have occurred in the anime but didn't, and is very very dramatic, and also very, for people who like angst and, you know, depression and, dare I say it, Byronic heroes, you know, this will certainly, I think, satisfy their desires.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, so we should move on to the films. So I'm curious to know, how do you guys feel about these films? Just sort of basic impressions and how you feel they're stacking up so far. And I guess we'll start with Aaron on that.
The first film, I'm a little torn over because it feels so different from the second one. It's like that shit that you just got to get out of the way,
mm-hmm,
before you can actually do something.
Yep.
And you can look at it that way. You can look at it the other way, which is, I want to say the original plan for the four films, or the, I guess, two films and then a third long film with another half of it, was that it was all going to come out between 2007 and 2008, and that it was going to be like a re-edit of the television series and then a new ending. And the first film kind of feels like that, because it's not wildly divergent, aside from some apparent visual carryovers from the end of Evangelion, with, you know, the red oceans and the blood stain on the moon and the cross shape outlines and a very quizzical line by Kaoru about wanting to meet him again or something to that effect. I can't remember exactly how it was translated in the official release off the top of my head. But it seems like as the production has progressed, it's sort of grown into something totally different from what they kind of set out to do. And you kind of see that in the differences between the first film and the second film. Like, the first film isn't that divergent at all. It starts and ends at the same place as it is in the television series. They reuse a lot of assets from the first film, and it's almost as if it's like an elaborate director's cut of the first six episodes of the television series. I love the ending of it, like the second half of it, the second 40 minutes of it are great. I love it. Angel of Doom is my favorite piece of music from the entire franchise. But it's like kind of redundant, you know. It's like it's just something they had to go through to get to where we start with the second film, which is a wildly, rapidly divergent take on similar events. Like, there's only like a handful of cuts that were, you know, of footage that were redone from the original show. Like, you know, like there's one cut of there's a few cuts in the scene where Kaji goes to Gendo's office, and like Gendo's looking down and he looks up, and then Kaji kind of like looks over his shoulder. Like, those two cuts of animation are reused from the original series, and they're so apparent because so much in the second film is, you know, totally new. Like, even if it's like an updated version of the events for previous episode, they didn't bother, you know, tracing over or recreating those, you know, frames of animation. They just did it completely from scratch, like a totally new interpretation of it. And just how far they get in terms of the plot of the original series is astounding. And I can sum up the second film with only one word, and that word is already, because it's just crazy how much ground they kind of cover in it. And I really, really like the second film a lot. It's very refreshing, and I like how it feels like it's the best things about Evangelion mixed with the best things of Diebuster.
Carl?
Well, I agree with what Aaron said. I think it's a very dynamic, entertaining, fast-moving reimagining of the original story. And Anno's been kind of reimagining the story from the very beginning. He's never stopped imagining it. You know, the TV series, no sooner was the TV series, you know, made, there was talk about, well, we're going to make some new footage, a director's cut. The basic idea of retelling the story in digest form was expressed by the Death film, which came out before the end of Evangelion. So, you know, basically Evangelion has never really been over. I guess, as far as Anno's concerned. And, you know, a reboot after 15 years is nothing that extraordinary by, you know, Hollywood standards. So I guess nothing to be surprised about when it comes to anime either. I think this is a very effective, you know, reimagining of Evangelion for a new generation. Having said that, you know, and in a parallel universe over here, I've said this before, but I would prefer the films had not been made at all. And what I mean by that is, it's not because I think Evangelion is some sacred, you know, thing which must never be sullied by remake or all that. It's just, as an anime fan, the thing I want most is I want new, interesting anime. Evangelion is such a phenomenon that we kind of forget that when it first came out, it wasn't a remake of anything. You know, it was new. It came out of left field and surprised everybody. Now, part of the enjoyment now is that we are also familiar with these characters, and a lot of us are familiar with the basic outline of the story, that when you watch these films, you're often looking for, you're not only being surprised by what's new, but you're looking for, okay, how are they going to handle that? Okay, how is that character going to come in, and how is that character going to do things differently in this scene than they did last time? The new movies are full of little, you know, little hits and Easter eggs, so to speak, like that. But what I really would like to see, you know, from Anno is something new. And Mr. Yamaga, again, the co-producer of the original Evangelion and the president of Gainax, he mentioned that the split that has occurred recently in which a new studio, Kara, was created, K-H-A-R-A, which you'll see in the Evangelion credits, this was a new studio that was created to make the new Evangelion films. And the way Mr. Yamaga explains it, in 2006 or so, Anno had the idea to make these films, and Gainax was already gearing up to make Gurren Lagann. And they couldn't make both at the same time, so they sort of decided to form a split studio and go off. But I think there's something, even though Gurren Lagann, I really like Gurren Lagann, it's a good series. It's not the phenomenon that Evangelion is, but there is something to be said about Gurren Lagann in that it's not a remake of anything. You know, obviously it takes strong inspiration from, you know, heroic robot shows, but you know what I mean. It's a new series. You know, Panty with Stocking Garterbelt, you know, that's a new series. You know, it takes a lot of inspiration. So, even before I was an Evangelion fan, I was a Gainax fan. And what I really want to see most is new work. So, I have two completely separate opinions about the films. I think that they're really good, they're really well done, and they're probably much more effective at getting people into Evangelion than asking people to go back and watch, you know, the 1995 series and all that with its 95 anime and so forth. So, I'm totally happy in a way that they're out. My hope is for the future that he's going to do something that's not Evangelion. And the films, I think, must be coming from an entirely different context for Anno. He's had a lot of, you know, personal changes. He went through the, you know, the psychological storm of the original. Since then, he's gotten married. You know, it's obviously a big change in everyone's life. He's married to Miyoko Anno, the well-known mangaka of Happy Mania, Sugar Sugar Rune, and Flowers and Bees, and so forth. So I'm very curious as to how he himself views these things. You know, I would have thought after the original Evangelion that he would have never wanted to hear the name Evangelion again, you know, and that he'd certainly never want to go to any convention because he'd be besieged with all these questions of the type we've been asking, what does it mean, Mr. Anno, what does it mean? And, you know, he left anime for some time after Evangelion, you know, sort of walking off the production of Kari Kano, if you remember that television series. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested just in the sheer fact that as a creator and director that he's been able to return to the series, which previously was associated with some, you know, rather strong psychological feelings with him. And so for that reason, it really isn't a remake in many ways. It's kind of if it is a remake, it's a remake that is coming from a different emotional and psychological place. I really feel it has to be. So in a way that makes it a sort of fresh interpretation of Evangelion. It's not just about, oh, I would have done this scene differently. It's more of, I'm doing this now for different reasons. And for that reason, I think it's very interesting as an Evangelion work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in agreement with that. I do want to see what else he's got in him. I want to see what else he's got in the barrel, so to speak. I'm interested in what other things he can do creatively. But at the same time, like, I fell asleep during the first movie because it was just so familiar. And
exactly.
As I was watching it, I was like, this is not what I was hoping for. I wanted something totally different. Like, okay, same characters, same basic outline, but give me something new. In that first movie, until the very end of it, I was dozing off. The second movie was a thrill ride. Like, I was totally into it from frame one to the very end. And that was the movie I wanted. That was exactly what I wanted. So having seen that second movie, I'm really glad these are being made because they're awesome. They're just great entertainment.
Exactly. And I don't think people who are new to Evangelion, which are going to be a lot of people, will have the same problems we had with the first movie because they haven't seen it before. And it's a really good introduction that's, you know, state-of-the-art anime, you know, very well done, well thought out. So the first movie may have, you know, problems for people like us who know the series, but for people who are new to it, it's a great introduction.
I think to an extent, I think it's a little choppy because they are just sort of cramming TV episodes together. Narratively, to me, it feels a little messy, but I'm also aware that they're cramming TV episodes together. So maybe somebody who's not familiar with that won't recognize this is a little choppy. In terms of the one thing I did want to ask about, and this is definitely how I felt, especially in the first one, less so in the second one because what was happening was new. But in the first one, I felt like some of the subtlety in the expression of these emotions that we've been talking about this whole time, the subtlety was kind of stripped away. And instead of the characters slowly revealing these things about themselves and their inner insecurities and the things they don't like, behaviors they don't approve of, things like that, I feel like in the first movie, they were just straight up, basically, it was treated like it was exposition, where it's like Misato sitting there explaining all of her character flaws, which, I don't know, did you guys get that at all? Am I completely off base on that?
Oh, no, it's definitely been bypassed. It's a much more straightforward actioner in terms of story. Just to briefly kind of touch upon what Carl was talking about, Ono's pushing 50 now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's born 19. He's 50. He's born 1960. Yeah.
Yeah. So while I love where this series of films is now, I'm really hoping he's not wasting his prime on redoing something that he's already done, and I also hope that this just isn't a attempt to get venture capital for his, you know, his new company. You know, like Miyazaki, when he was his age, Miyazaki was making Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away because that was like his prime. You know, it's like his high point, but Ono is just kind of playing with the old. But
that's kind of the positive conspiracy theory that he's, you know, he's banking away all this, you know, revenue from the Evangelion films, you know, so he can be free to make something else.
Yeah, but there's so much. They're very straightforward, though. You know, it doesn't delve into the psychology as much. It doesn't delve into the religious aspects as much. Like right off the bat, when they're doing the abridged version of the first episode, Unit 1 doesn't move to protect Shinji. You know, there's no indication of the mother's soul in the Ava. You know, there's none of these sort of contacts with the angels when the pilots are incapacitated or whatever. You know, like, they totally bypass some of the most, you know, sort of kind of like key or pivotal moments in the television series. You know, you don't have Shinji being taken into the Shadow Angel, the Sea of Duroc. You don't see that happening. You know, that's sort of one of those key moments where he addresses the fact that his mother's soul is in the Ava. You don't see Asuka being mind raped by Ariel, that the angel floating in space. You know, and coming into grips with certain aspects of her character and going on her sort of downward spiral. You know, you don't see the double helix, energy band angel Armesael fusing with Unit Zero and making Rey kind of come to terms with certain aspects of, you know, her angelic nature. You know, they just completely bypass some of these kind of, you know, core pivotal moments in the television series, and that makes it accessible, I think, to a slightly broader fan base, perhaps, because it's not so obfuscated. But like what we were talking about earlier, in that Ava is kind of purposely abstract, allowing it to be interpreted in different ways and people to find different meaning in it. This new series doesn't really have that, because it's kind of more straightforward. It doesn't have quite as much double entendre. It doesn't kind of play with all these different characters' emotions or motives. But then again, we still have 3.0 and Final, which may or may not be totally separate films. My understanding is that 3.0 or Final is kind of like a companion piece to go along with 3.0, and that they're going to be released at the same time. So my sincere hope is that while these may be kind of straightforward compared to the TV series, they'll find a way to make it all kind of work together and complement the original. Like, ideally, I would love it if they did something similar to Die Buster, where the end of Die Buster and the end of Gun Buster sync up in this very, very nice and thoughtful and creative way. Because there are these kind of visual cues in the new films from the end of Evangelion that I pointed out earlier that kind of suggest that they are in continuity in this kind of weird Groundhog Day kind of thing. And there's also another line that Kaoru delivers later on that, again, kind of toys with this kind of subtle but kind of apparent, you know, circular, you know, repeating idea of, you know, maybe these two things are actually in continuity. But that's kind of a really long kind of fan debate that kind of goes on, you know, in the annals of the fandom.
In defense of poor 1.0, I thought there was one scene which was very brief but like quite emotionally shocking and reminded me of the best of the original TV series. It again it's paralleling the events of the fourth episode Hedgehog's Dilemma, where Shinji sort of runs away from Nerve and sort of goes off on his own. And it's a scene where he's sleeping on the street, like a homeless guy. And he's not in an alley or anything. He's like, people are practically stepping on his head, and they're completely ignoring him. Perhaps it shows in part how things have changed in the past 15 years in Japan. People are a lot more used to seeing homeless people there now, because, you know, the economy has basically never really recovered, and a lot of people don't have, you know, permanent work anymore. But just the kind of sense of how alone and discarded it is, Shinji is, but showing in a new way that, you know, this kind of image that people might see every day now on the streets of Tokyo, and, hey, this is Shinji Ikari, he's, you know, this 14-year-old kid, you know, and he doesn't care either. I mean, he doesn't hesitate to sleep, you know, in an alley himself. So this gives you a little bit of a sense of, you know, where he's coming from and just how desolate he is. So while the need to sort of digest the events and to sort of remove a lot of, you know, time out to have character interaction, yes, I do feel that. I think there were some moments in the movie which did kind of move me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not to suggest that the first movie is bad by any means. I just think for seasoned fans, and, you know, we've talked about this, the second one is sort of like, oh, this is what they're going to do. All right, you know, now I'm on board.
Well, they went for theatrical interpretations, because, after all, it is a movie and not a TV show.
Right.
You know, they were thinking big. You see a real contrast, for example, in scenes like in the TV show when the Nerve Men in Black come for Shinji. Shinji was in, you know, Kensuke's pup tent. He kind of run into him and sort of hang out and talk there and found a place to spend the night. You know, in the morning there's like four guys, you know, standing around the tent and, you know, ask him to come out. In the movie, of course, that's handled. He's, you know, wandering around dazed. It's like something out of Akira, this, you know, highway construction that comes to an end. He's over this black abyss, can't go any further. You know, they kind of cries out in frustration, and it turns out they've been following all this time. you know, this, you know, big SWAT presence and helicopters and all that. So the same type of idea that he kind of, you know, they're drawing him back in, but it's expressed in a lot more, you know, big budget, you know, Hollywood type of way. And maybe, again, that's appropriate, you know, for a film as opposed to a TV series.
Yeah, I liked that moment, especially because it really did. I feel like Gendo is a much more monolithic presence in the films and much more direct in how much of a dick he is. And
yes.
I felt like I felt like Shinji, that moment where he turns around from the abyss, and it's kind of like they're just indulging him. They're just like, all right, go have your cry fest. We'll be right here when you're ready to fucking turn around. You know, he was never really alone. They were following him kind of the whole time, like totally indulging his little wine fest.
And you really get a sense that it's not that Gendo doesn't like Shinji or that he's indifferent. He hates Shinji.
Right.
I mean, it would actually be easy. Wouldn't it be easier for him if he pretended to like him?
Right.
You know, there are a lot of parents who don't really like their children, but they pretend to. I mean, wouldn't it save Gendo a lot of drama and a lot of trouble if he just threw Shinji a few crumbs? I mean, I know he throws him a few crumbs, you know, you did a good job today and that sort of thing. But, you know, Gendo is such a hard ass that it really often works against what he's trying to accomplish, that is fighting the angels and all that. The classic example I give is, again, the episode where Bardiel attacks Nerve and Shinji is resigned because of the whole affair with Toji. And the only thing that basically saves the human race at that point is Shinji runs into Kaji and, you know, his watermelon patch. And Kaji is the one who kind of convinces Shinji to go back at the very last moment and, you know, with just seconds to go, you know, burst in with his Evangelion unit, you know, and save the day. But if it hadn't been for that little encounter with Kaji, you know, plot-wise, the series would have been over at that point. And, you know, Gendo just couldn't say, I'm sorry, couldn't say, well, I know that was hard, son, and believe me, I'm feeling it as much as you are. You know, he couldn't fake it. So Gendo was seriously messed up as well, and messed up in a way that, you know, he seems to be this master conspirator and a guy who's really in control, but, you know, his emotional problems, you know, create a lot of problems for himself, just like they do for Shinji. And, yeah, you do feel that, you know, rather intensely in the new films. Especially for people who have seen the series before, it's like, geez, these guys haven't learned anything.
Okay, so before we wrap up, obviously the films are still ongoing, so that's sort of the future of the franchise as it sits right now. I guess we can conclude with what are you really hoping to see from the end of this new cycle of films? What are you sort of hoping for? And I guess we can start with Aaron.
I kind of answered this question slightly already. I want to see this as sort of a meaningful addition to the work that already exists. I don't really want it to be, you know, some, like, it's never going to be better than the original. It's always going to be an addition to the franchise. I don't think that it could ever be more important than the original series, because, you know, it's so iconic and it's, you know, a trendsetter. It has influenced countless series since it came out. But I hope that it's more than just a way of, you know, cashing in on something that is already still popular, making more, you know, like that they didn't just create, you know, that weird quadruped Ava for the sake of making a toy out of it. I hope that they didn't just create the new character Mari Makinami for the sake of making more figures. I hope that it's a reasoned, thoughtful, lasting addition to the franchise, more so than, you know, some of the games or some of the manga series or some of the merchandise. And I hope that they manage to find a way, or have a way, of kind of working it all together in the same continuity, or even an alternate continuity that complements the original work, rather than just, you know, being more Ava, because we already have more Ava. And some of it is kind of substandard, some of it is decent, but we really need another strong entry into the franchise, and so far it looks like that's what this is. So I'm hoping that 3.0 and Final are a further step, you know, along than 2.0, which I thought was very, very good. 1.0 was kind of, you know, kind of redundant, but, you know, had its moments. And I'm hoping that 3.0, you know, just kind of sends the new movies out with a bang, and you know, people will, you know, talk about them years from now, you know, in similar ways as they do with the TV series.
Well, you mentioned that you hoped it would have an impact beyond the other aspects of the franchise. It's funny because the other Evangelion manga that I've been editing recently, the Shinji Ikari Racing Project, volume 11 of that is about to come out in Japan, and unlike Sadamoto-san's manga, this gets done on a regular basis.
And oh, yes.
I guess if it's not careful, it's going to lap him pretty soon, you know, and get beyond volume 12 and volume 13. This manga has a very distilled emphasis on the characters and the type of iconic characters they are and their relationships and all that. And in some ways, it's kind of where Evangelion is right now. It represents in a very pure form the idea I had that it's about these characters and, oh yeah, Asuka, Rei, Shinji, you know, the Eternal Triangle and so forth. The movies have made over $60 million at the Japanese box office so far, which is really good money for anime films.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to have been, you know, I know they have a big promotional deal with the Lawson chain. There's a Lawson that actually shows up in 2.0. And again, last time I was over in Japan, I always like to go to a Lawson's or a Family Mart, as opposed to, say, an anime show. These are Japanese equivalents of 7-Eleven, because there you're going to see the kind of anime and manga that ordinary Japanese people are into, you know, not just otaku. So only the most popular stuff, you know, is going to get into there. And, you know, number one thing was One Piece, but, like, number two is Evangelion. I think, again, these new films, what's the most interesting thing about them is that they're coming from a very different place in terms of emotions and psychology of the original. You might say perhaps that they're free of that, or that, you know, he's more free to imagine the story as a story and not just about what's going on with him personally. So that's what's exciting for me. And for that reason, I'm completely open to what he's doing. I don't necessarily have any requests or expectations for what's going to happen in the third or fourth films. I'm just curious to see what is going to happen, because, you know, so far it's, you know, it's gotten more and more interesting. I would just like to be surprised, personally. And considering how entertaining and visually spectacular they've been, I doubt I'm going to be, you know, let down, you know, by the experience. So, again, we're in new territory here, and I just like to sort of see where it leads.
Yeah, okay, well, I agree with both of you. And one thing that I'm really hoping for on a very shallow level is End of Evangelion has some of the most spectacular and memorable apocalyptic imagery in it I've ever seen. And I kind of hope they can top that. I don't think they can. They could try. I hope they try to top the crazy apocalyptic stuff that happens in End of Evangelion, because it's just spectacular.
Remember, we're only 4 years now from 2015, which
right.
is the year the story's actually set in. So, you know, I'm sure there's going to be some tremendous revival of Evangelion just 4 years from now. They can't miss that date.
Yeah.
So who really knows when this is going to end, you know what I'm saying?
For sure. And the other thing I am secretly hoping is that they use Kamsosertad at some point. I would really like to see that snuck in there somewhere, even just as an instrumental. Okay, guys. Well, listen, that was very informative, I think, and very very educational. And I really appreciate you both coming on and having this discussion and helping everyone sort of understand the show maybe a little more. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I'd just like to request, we have an ongoing fan art and letter column for the Evangelion manga. You can contact it at evangelion@darkhorse.com. That's one word, Dark Horse. And it's sort of a forum for discussing the series. The thing I like to hear most about often is people's personal experience with the shows and what it means to them. To me, that's just as interesting as trying to decode, you know, what it meant to the creators and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I guess that's where something really takes on a life of its own, you know, how it affects people. So, yeah, we'd love to hear from people.
Okay, well, thank you guys both. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Okie doke, that's our show. I want to thank Carl and Aaron for joining me. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And hey, see you all next week.